Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. Well, from time to time here on the program, we like to do shows that have to do with health, and have invited physicians who specialize in various parts of the body here to be on the program from time to time. And we're pleased this morning to have with us Dr. Malcolm Hill. He is a pediatrician from Carl Clinic in Urbana, and so we'll be talking about children's health. It is wide open. So anything, any of the kinds of questions you'd think about talking about with a pediatrician can be all manner of things dealing with bumps and bruises, immunizations, issues of development, any and all that, you know, the kind of pediatrician stuff. You can call in and talk with the doctor, and I know he will do his best to help you out. I always try to mention when we have physicians here on the program that we cannot do diagnosis over the phone. There are some limitations that we have here because the doctor can't see you and can't see your kids. But the reason we do these shows is to try to help you out, to add to your store of knowledge on healthcare, maybe give you a place to start. And of course, then if you have concerns about your children's health, you need to take those to somebody who can see them. But again, this is a place that you could start. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. I thought that maybe we could start here with something that's certainly been in the news lately. And that is what we can do for children to try to lower their risk of developing heart disease as they get older. And particularly, there was a recommendation that caused a lot of debate, I'm sure it did within the field of pediatrics, about putting children on statin drugs, whether we should be thinking about doing that. So how do you start approaching this issue of cholesterol and other things that might in a child that might then make it more likely that as that child grows that he or she is going to have problems with heart disease?
Well, I think it's multifactorial, though. It's, you know, we talk about screening for lipids, but there's many factors that tie into heart disease. There's family history, which tends to be very strong. There's obesity, hypertension, then there's your lipids. So all this is kind of tied together, and lipids is just one component. So I think as a society, we need to focus in on some of the basics, which we've kind of lost, which is, you know, really healthy lifestyle, which means getting exercise, limiting TV and some of the sedentary activities, eating healthy. A lot of families are stuck eating fast foods because of schedule or because it's cheaper than eating healthy. We're not putting any resources in, you know, we're not putting resources into this, which is disappointing as a country, as a public health department. You know, I think we need to have some healthcare policy here that's going to address some of this, because what we're doing is we're catching things after they've already developed. We're treating people with heart disease, with hypertension, with obesity, when really prevention is the cure. And we're really not getting there. So basically, I think that we need to start with the lifestyle, diet, exercise. There are some people that need to be screened, though, for various things. I think the lipid screening was one thing you brought up. There are some high-risk groups that should be screened, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has made some recommendations. That's, you know, kind of what we tend to follow. That we need to start screening early. And I was surprised to read some of the information, but they talked about starting at age two.
Really?
You know, now we always...
Not for all children, just for...
Well, screening meaning you start talking, asking questions, putting people in risk categories. So at age two, if you have risk factors that are significant, they're recommending that we do some fasting lipid profiles.
Really?
On these, yes. And I ask me if I'm there yet. No, I'm waiting for this to kind of settle. But if you have a family history of dyslipidemia, you know, abnormal lipids, you know, in the family, that's certainly one category. If you have a family history of early heart disease, type 2 diabetes, some of these things, then We're putting kids in a higher risk category, and some of these kids probably will be screened, and that's their recommendation. Then the question is, what do you do? Certainly, if the kids are overweight or heading that direction, you really start focusing in on the lifestyle intensely. If their lipids are abnormal, you know, you really need to get them to a dietitian and have them look at their diet carefully, the things I miss when I talk to families. Interesting, one family thought that fruit funds, you know, the fruit snacks were fruit. So you can learn some interesting things if you really get into detail. And, you know, so that's kind of where we're going. Then you monitor. You know, and I think this is somewhat new. I think we've been screening kids at a much older age, and being somewhat more selective.
Well, before now, what was the recommendation for the point at which you'd want to basically say almost anybody, you'd want to get a baseline cholesterol and blood sugar?
Well, it's fuzzy. With the blood sugar, at this point, the recommendation for kids are to screen after age 10 if they have risk factors. So with risk factors, if this, the state of Illinois actually has outlined this for the school physicals, really nice. If you're overweight, your BMI is greater than 85th percentile. If you have a family history of type 2 diabetes, if you have a certain if you're of a certain ethnic group, or if you have physical findings, physical signs, then you get should be screened. Mm-hmm. And that still holds. With the lipids, it was fuzzy. Mm-hmm. I think generally my choice was to screen kids that were overweight, kids that have a family history of diabetes, kids that had the high risk with the family history of lipid problems or early cardiovascular disease. And those kids were screened, usually in their teenage years. But we could, you know, certainly screen earlier. But I think these recommendations are pretty firm and much clearer, at least, mm-hmm. in terms of screening.
But at least as far as you're concerned and as far as physicians are concerned, it sounds as if it's still we're not talking about blanket screening. What we're mm-hmm. talking about is based on the patient profile,
right.
Their history, their family history. You're looking at specific risk factors,
right.
So that once you collect all that information and you look at that, then it should be pretty clear which kids should be screened for what.
I think so. Okay. I guess I'm using the term screening in two different ways, but I think, you know, screening being a good history physical and then lipid profiles being drawn for the high risk group.
Yeah.
Correct.
There certainly now for quite a few years there has been a lot of concern, and we see it in popular media, about children's health in terms of their weight and activity mm-hmm. level, the fact that we are starting to see significant numbers of children that are developing the type 2 mm-hmm. diabetes, that thing that we used to call adult onset mm-hmm. because children didn't get
right.
it. It wasn't the kind of
right.
kind of thing that you're born with. It's mm-hmm. it's the thing that develops later in life. And also then increasing numbers of children that are in what we call pre-diabetes, that mm-hmm. we're saying, well, they don't technically have diabetes, mm-hmm. but if we don't do anything, they're
right.
going to.
Right.
And at the same time, I guess I also read articles that say, well, yes, now that's true, but we need to be a little careful about how about not blowing this out completely out of proportion, you know. So I guess I'm a little bit confused about how we steer that course mm-hmm. between what is a appropriate mm-hmm. concern about recognizing something that really is a problem, and then mm-hmm. then something that's, you know, that's going to lead us to overreact.
Right.
I guess I'm just not really okay. quite sure where we are.
Right. Well, I think the problem is that, you know, diabetes by definition is a blood sugar fasting greater than 126, which is high, or just a random blood sugar of 200 or better. But anything under that, you know, wasn't diabetes. Well, it's kind of a false sense of security, because I think any blood sugar over 100 fasting or over 120, you know, 140 after meals or whatever is not normal. And they're finding, you know, with good research that people in this pre-diabetic range have problems. They're having problems with the acceleration of atherosclerosis. And so, you know, it's kind of, we took an arbitrary point and called it diabetes, but I think it's a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
It's not normal.
Mm-hmm.
So actually some new recommendations are coming out, which I'm happy to see, from the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists, and they basically are saying we need to treat this group more aggressively. Now, obviously, with type 2 diabetes initially, the treatment's going to be, you've heard it again, exercise, weight loss, lifestyle. And that's certainly important. But what they're doing in this group is they're saying, well, if that doesn't work, which it often doesn't, then maybe we need to start treating groups at higher risk with medication, even for the pre-diabetic. And I think they're going to have to look at the terminology here going forward. So I think, you know, with our screening of kids, we're finding these kids early. I had one today. It was, instead of 200, the blood sugar was 196. Okay. Now, I just told him, you have type 2 diabetes. You know, I don't, you know, this is where you're going. This is what we're going to treat you for. Yeah. And we got all the education in place. We got all the testing in place. We're going to get the diet in place. We're going to do everything aggressively because, you know, it's senseless to wait till the blood sugar is 200.
Yeah.
So it's good to see these recommendations to give us some guidelines on this because we've been in kind of limbo for years.
So now I'm just curious with this particular patient how he or she, I don't know anything about it, and but how the patient reacted. Did they say, yeah, I guess I understand what you're saying. I recognize the problem. I know what I got to do, and I'm going to get on that. Did you seem to – what sort of response did you get?
Well, I think of kind of a blank look. It's a silent disease right now. So we talked a lot about, you know, how it impacts your body and this and that. But obviously, it's for teenagers, it's going to probably bounce off. They're more concerned about what happens tomorrow, not 10 years from now. But this person's mother surely understood. She had a brother with type 2 diabetes. She's pre-diabetic. And so it's going to have to be a family thing. We're going to really get him educated and really get him motivated as best we can. But it's a tough route, tough thing to get people to buy into. We're going to get him tested. You know, we're going to have him do some testing and try to get him to buy into it, get him involved in the care. And it's not easy for adults. Well, for teenagers, it's triple hard. His favorite food's pizza, and luckily he doesn't drink much in the way of soft drinks, but, you know, it's tough.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He is a pediatrician from Carle Clinic in Urbana. We're talking about children's health and whatever questions you might have. You're certainly welcome to call. We have somebody here ready to go who's calling from Mattoon, and we'll get right to them. But anybody else who's listening, you certainly can call in. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here. Mattoon, line 4.
Thank you.
Yes.
Doctor, my granddaughter is starting a new teaching job, one-on-one as a teacher's aide with an autistic child who is 6. And all I know about his reactions is that he swears and he hits. And this is the first time she will have had a teaching position, and I wondered if you had any suggestions on how to cope with a child like this.
Well, it's difficult. Is she going to be more one-on-one with this child?
Yes, she is.
Yeah, I think, you know, the kids tend to be hard to handle, obviously. I think a lot of times the more physical you get with those kids, sometimes the more physical they are with you. So sometimes you just need to kind of step back and let them go through their tirade or whatever. I think you get to know these kids with, you know, by working with them. Each one's an individual with individual triggers.
Right.
And, you know, they need a calm, very calming, I guess, environment. Talking with the parents or people that have worked with this child before will be very important to know what works and what doesn't. And without knowing the child specifically, I can't really give you any more information. But
I didn't think so, but I just thought maybe you had some hints. I think you have given me some ideas to follow up.
Well, I certainly would hope that they would help her with this in terms of giving her information about the child. And she'll spend a lot of time hopefully interviewing parents or previous teachers. So.
Yes. Well, I'll mention that to her, and she can proceed in that area.
Well, I'm glad she's in that field. That's really it's a tough field to be in. So,
I think it'll be a real challenge for her, and she's not had any teaching experience. She's a cosmetologist by trade, but this is something she wants to try.
There's probably some reading available, too, through some of the foundations, too, that you could probably connect with. We have a developmentalist at our clinic who probably can give her some tips, too.
Would there be something on the internet?
Oh, yeah. Suppose? Yeah. If she has time, she might try contacting Chuck Morton, Charles Morton at Carl Clinic, if she needs specific information about autism or possibly support groups or websites.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sir.
Have a good day.
Right, thank you. Other kinds of questions are welcome. Our guest, again, here in the Sparta Focus 580 is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carl Clinic, and we're talking about children's health. And I'm sure that anything that has to do, any of the kinds of questions you could think of asking a pediatrician, you can call in and ask, and he'll do his best.
I'll try.
He'll try.
Behavior is probably one of the most difficult things to assess and to really make recommendations on. It's often very complicated, involves often a lot of family issues, structure in this thing. Getting back to one comment, you were asking about treatment of cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get that far on that, but actually in the past, you know, no matter what the range, typically we weren't using statins for kids with elevated cholesterol. But now I think the kind of recommendations are that we take a second look at that, that after we've gone through the diet and lifestyle, if there's still significant abnormalities and the LDL cholesterol, that these kids be treated.
Mm-hmm.
I've treated some kids that are 10 to 12 years of age but have not been willing to drop below that. But I think now there's some definite suggestion that we do that.
Is there any hesitancy to use medications that generally are used in adults and when they have been tested on adults?
Oh, yeah.
But not generally given to kids. I mean, do you think to yourself, you know, I'm not really so sure. I guess the idea always has been that a child is essentially a small adult,
mm-hmm.
so you just scale back your dosage,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and you figure that should be okay. But how do you think about it?
Well, you know, we do use a lot of medications that aren't approved. They're called orphan drugs. I mean, things that we use for years have not been tested in kids in terms of FDA testing. And we've been fairly lucky. But, you know, drugs that have not been used in kids, we're really out there. We have to be very careful. I believe that a lot of this should happen in university settings where they're doing good clinical trials, which they're going on now with the statins. And so far, the safety of the statins has been, I think, proven, at least for the most part, if you monitor carefully. And so I don't think pediatricians in the general or family practitioners in the general community should be starting with new drugs in kids without some careful thought. And also, we hope that someone's done some clinical trials and proven that there's reasonably safe before we venture out there. But it's a tough situation because you can't do a lot of clinical trials in kids.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure for any patient, for adult, for example, you go into your doctor, they check your cholesterol. The doctor
mm-hmm.
says, well, this is higher than it should be, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. Here's how we're
mm-hmm.
going to start.
Mm-hmm.
And statins are not going to be the first thing.
No.
He's going to say, okay, you know the drill. I almost
mm-hmm.
don't even need to tell you this. But here's the thing. We got to look at your diet. We got to look
mm-hmm.
at your lifestyle. We'd like you to eat healthy. Mm-hmm. We'd like to get some regular exercise. And, you know, we'll do that for 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and then you'll come back, and we'll
mm-hmm.
check again, and we'll see how you're doing. Well, some people, when they come back, they'll check again, and the doctor will say, okay, looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Keep doing that.
Yep.
Some people will come back, and maybe it's not enough. The doctor says, okay, well, I want you to keep doing that, but there's something else we have to do here. I think
mm-hmm.
it's important for you to have that medication,
mm-hmm.
and we'll see if we can get it down more.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm thinking of, say, you have a child,
mm-hmm.
and you take the first step,
mm-hmm.
and you're pretty sure the kid's doing pretty good, trying
mm-hmm.
to do what they should be doing, but that doesn't do enough. So then you say, okay, we're going to put you on this medication. Do you think of that person, you know, say you start 8, 9 years old, start taking statins. Are you thinking to yourself, now this person's going to be taking this this medication for the rest of their life?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Diet can only probably reduce your cholesterol by, maybe I'm an error here, but about 20% maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these families have extremely high cholesterol. They need to be on medication. And if the data is correct, if, you know, this atherosclerotic heart disease and vascular disease starts early, then probably we're being negligent and not treating some of these kids early.
And this is something, it's something about that person, their body, how it processes food
yep.
and so forth, and that is a... It's a genetic kind
it's
of
a
deal. And
yes, it's a genetic problem where their liver just produces too much of the wrong kind of cholesterol. So it's an internal thing. Even if you didn't eat, you'd still have high cholesterol.
Mm-hmm. And is diabetes a little bit, is it that more amenable to lifestyle treatment? Say you've got somebody in pre-diabetes, or is that also the thing where if you see parents, mm-hmm. Other close relatives mm-hmm. who have the same sort of issues, then you're going to say, well, go and do what mm-hmm. we want you to do. Go and have a good lifestyle, mm-hmm. but that they're still likely that at some point we may have to get into doing some medication.
Oh, almost certainly. I think if you aren't real specific about your recommendations to these people too, you're not going to get anywhere. And it's a tough road anyway. But if you're not really spending a lot of time with them and helping them problem solve, if the family has poor habits, you send mm-hmm. that kid back, even if you give them specifics, it's going to be hard. But if you send them out without specifics on exercise, when, what, how often, and a checklist, if you don't send them out with real specific information on diets and help them with it, it's not going to happen. Yeah. And even then, your success rate's fairly low, unfortunately. Yeah. We have a problem in society, you know.
Yeah, I guess I found myself, wondering, because we do identify bad habits, mm-hmm. maybe bad diet, lack of exercise, too much time in front of the computer or the yep. TV or, whatever. And I wonder to what extent that really is an issue, and to what extent that is something that we can do something about that way, like that we can do something about lifestyle-wise, and whether there might be something else going on that won't deal with, and in fact that we do find ourselves saying, well, if we really want to treat this, yes, we're going to have to turn to these medications because the other stuff is only going to take you so far.
Only so far, but I don't want to give up on the idea that as a country we can be healthier. I just really mm-hmm. – there's no public health policy in this country anyway. We're just – everything – healthcare is wild. Spend as much as we can on whatever we can. There's no real priorities being set. And it's partly the physician's fault, and it's partly the government's fault, and it's – who knows? But I think we need to get together on this and really put some time and energy into what's important and what's cost effective. Classic, example was prostate screening. Did you see that?
Yes.
Don't screen people over 75. Don't screen men over 75 for prostate cancer because it doesn't. First of all, if your treatment's worse than the disease, most people are going to die of something else before. Right. But yet you get these people at 75. Where we're doing prostatectomies on them and they're having all sorts of problems and they die in the hospital. So I think we need to really focus in and have somebody take charge here. And I think it'll happen, but it's unfortunately going to be tough. TV, I think all these things that are – I asked one mother, what does a child like to do at a school physical at the health department, and child likes to watch TV, and the student was there and asked how many hours of TV this child watches. And mom says, between 6 hours and 8 hours a day. And we just kind of dropped our jaws. So, this obesity thing, the diabetes, the lipids, all this is really going with the increase in obesity in this country, and it started about 25 years ago. And it's not the genetics. Mm-hmm. This is our environment.
So, when you see kids, at what point do you? And I guess the best way to think about this is with the body mass index, mm-hmm. which is a number that you get by mm-hmm. doing crunching the numbers of the mm-hmm. of the weight and the height, mm-hmm. right? So you come up with a number.
Correct.
That's probably the best. Makes a little bit more sense than just going by weight.
Right.
Alone or
right.
age alone or anything like that. So at what point do you start to be concerned by weight in a child?
Well, body mass index is a reasonable way of looking at being overweight or obese. It's not perfect, okay? Actually, they're looking at abdominal girth as actually being more sensitive in adults. And we don't quite have that worked out in kids yet. But mm-hmm. you can imagine abdominal obesity actually is probably the biggest risk factor. But the BMI above 85th percentile is what we're targeting is look out, you're at risk. And, that's kind of arbitrary, but, certainly probably an appropriate, point to start talking significantly. I usually just show the BMI to the family every visit, and if the trend is up, even if it's not at the 85th percentile, we're talking about that and kind of looking a little bit more at what the kids are doing or not doing.
So that's going to be – it's going to be different. Your sort of ideal target numbers are going to be different for every child depending on age?
Age, Correct.
Okay. And that's and if people are curious about their BMI, there are plenty of places on the web. You had internet access, calculators that you can use. Mm-hmm. It's very easy. As long as you can, as long as you know how much you weigh and how tall you are, you can put those two numbers in there and press the key, and it'll figure it out for you.
And there's a growth chart, basically, for BMI, sort of chart that puts you at the 50th percentile or the 85th or whatever. And it does vary with age. Mm-hmm. So you can't talk about a normal number for a BMI for a child. You have to look at their age.
And over the past 5 years, have you seen the BMIs on average going up? Are you seeing kids that are heavier and heavier?
I don't know if over the last 5 years, but I think we see a lot of heavy kids. I mean, the last physicals that we did at the health department, almost everybody was over the 85th percentile. Mm-hmm. It was scary.
Let's take another call here. Someone on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm an adult. I hope it's obvious. but I have a body mass index that's just darn near perfect. And I get called, I think I know what these kids that aren't chunky are up against. Because, I mean, this weekend I was called grotesquely skinny by somebody that hadn't seen me in a while. And I've only lost maybe 15 pounds. But I mean, it's kind of like I'm getting pretty tired of being called skinny, and it's just kind of, you look around, and I know I've been about the same size for pretty much all my life in shirt size, and I went from wearing an extra large in high school to now I'm darn near a small, and it just seems like the whole society's concept of what normal weight is has changed, and I'll hang up that comment.
Okay.
Yeah, interesting. Well, congratulations if you feel healthy and you're on the thin side. I wish I knew what you did for a living and what your lifestyle was like, but that's probably the secret. Also, there's a lot of family history involved. I mean, genetically speaking, there are people that are storers and people that aren't. And so if you take a bunch of people that are genetically tend to put weight on and to store in foods, then if you give them excess calories, they store it. Now, I'm not ultra thin, but I'm on the slender side, I guess, right, David? Thank you. David is really on the slender. He looks great. But, probably he's not a storer, so he can probably eat fairly healthy and not deal with caloric restriction much and stay decent weight. And so some families have an uphill battle. And you'd say it's not fair. Well, it may not be, but that's what they're dealt with. And so that's contributing. But that has not changed in this country. The genetics has not changed in a great degree over 25 years. It's unfortunately that we've had less active lives. And, when I was growing up, we ran and played outside. We had one TV station. Sorry, lots of radio, though.
One TV station.
Yeah, or maybe two. I don't know. And it didn't come in very well. But so that was, then we played outside and had, used our imagination and didn't have Xboxes or any boxes, so... Yeah. Or we had cardboard boxes. So. Those worked very well.
Okay. We're a couple old guys. You want to give a call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Malcolm Hill. The youthful Dr. Malcolm Hill, pediatrician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. We're talking about children's health this morning. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I appreciate your show. I understand the use of BMI when you're looking at large populations, especially since it's an inexpensive way to make a first analysis. But when you're seeing people individually, wouldn't body fat analysis be better, or is that not standardized for children?
And I'm going to probably tell you that we used to use body fat. Fat use calipers and things of this sort when we did nutritional assessments, but generally pediatricians don't spend a lot of time doing that for whatever reason. There's some data on that, and certainly I think it probably follows BMI to some degree. So we've kind of more or less decided to use the BMI because we have more data on it, and we have kind of recommendations on how to handle that. But no, skin folds are used. There are kids that have elevated BMI that have, if you want to call them, big boned and have, large muscle mass. And so actually some of the more complicated methods can be used to sort that out, body plethysmography and some things of that sort, which I don't have access to. So you have to use your judgment with the BMI. It's not 100% accurate. That's why I was mentioning abdominal girth and some things in adults is being used, and we're trying to work that out in kids as well. That actually might be more helpful.
I see. So the modern impedance body fat analysis is not quicker and more accurate?
I'll pass on that because I can't give you an educated answer today.
Okay.
But, you know, I certainly think that the body fat itself is important.
Okay. Well, that's good to know about
analyzing
the BMI, because I'm one of those people that's been athletic and to get a high BMI, that's not always the best.
I agree. It's not always perfect. I have some people that I know, they're having problems with insurance because their BMI is elevated and they're just as fit as can be, and they're runners and weightlift, and it's primarily muscle mass. So sometimes it does give you false information.
Thank you very much.
You're
for
welcome.
Your call and your comments.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Two things. One is I have grandkids who live in another part of the country, and when we were visiting them during the wintertime, the parents had come up with some fun exercises to do with the kids, hiding multicolored blocks around the house, and then both the parent and the kid racing to see who could find the most in a given amount of time. So the parent, as well as the kid, was getting exercise. And the mother specifically stated, kids, we have to have this amount of vegetables and fruits during the day and this amount of exercise. We're, you know, sort of a mental check-off thing. Have we had our 30 minutes of exercise yet today? No, okay, let's come up and do this sort of thing. And it was a parental involvement as well as with kids. So that's one thing. The other is, often when I'm thinking about people's perceptions of being overweight, I'm somebody who needs to work on my own weight, and I'm trying to exercise every day. Not doing very well at the moment, but when I go to Carl or Christy, I look around at the medical staff, and I see a lot of very overweight people. And it seems to me that it's modeling that this is okay. And obviously, you can't hire people based on their body weight, but I'm wondering whether Carl is doing things to help its own employees attain healthy weights so that they can also, not only for their own health, but also to model for their patients what looks normal. I saw somewhere, maybe it was Consumer Reports on Health, that people often don't realize how big they are, and using one of the advantages of using a tape measure and you're doing your waist measurement is you can say if you have a waist over this size, the chances are you're going to have heart problems. You can do that for an adult more easily than you can for a kid because adults are finished growing. But anyway, a couple of thoughts there, and I'm wondering what Carl is doing for its own employee health initiatives. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. It's good. You know, I think the parents' involvement is obviously necessary when it comes to anything with their children, setting good examples. There's the genetic component of it, which you fight, and then there's the family component, which is their habits. If your family activity is we're going to watch TV together with our TV trays and our dinner, it's probably going to, you know, lead to some issues. So obviously, you know, parents are very important in this equation, but they're also, you know, dealing with societal issues as well. Sometimes both parents work. They don't have time to prepare food. There's cost issues and things of this sort. So, you know, I think obviously parents that problem solve, that have the ability to problem solve, are going to do much better. If they can't problem solve, then you need to be then healthcare people need to really be more specific and give more details and more structure to their treatment. Carl, I think we're just like any other folks, I try to set a good example for you know, my patients. I always wear my bike helmet. I would not be caught without it. You know, certainly trying to eat healthy. And I would have a hard time talking about it with them if I didn't. You know, I feel like I can talk with authority, or at least somewhat. And I think that Carl itself, though, being an organization, we can't discriminate, obviously, against people in terms of hiring. But we have offered significant incentives to our employees to stay healthy with their health plan. And they have to go through a survey. They work with a counselor. And they get some, I guess, some benefits from that financially. And that includes a number of things, including having everybody go in and be measured, their abdominal girth is measured. Unfortunately, mine was like on the border about 2 years ago, but it's better now. And, you know, blood pressure, and really they are incenting people to do the best they can, and then they get a yearly follow-up. And we also have a weight management plan. But other than that, we have not done anything specific. We have had some walks for this or that, but not with the particular aim of weight control. But,
okay.
You know, I think, you know, certain organizations are doing a much better job of that. I'm sure you've read about, you know, organizations that allow their employees to exercise, you know, have appropriate facilities at work, and they are given incentives. And I think that's surely an important part of the plan. This is the big plan. And maybe there should be more incentives for business to do that, you know. So they find that the workers are more productive.
All right.
Healthier.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carl Clinic, talking about children's health. And if you want to give us a call, have a question about the children in your life, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something I want to make sure that we just touch on, because it's, you know, so much a big part of your practice, and that's immunization. I just wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about that, and particularly whether is there anything that's particularly new or has changed recently?
Yes, and when kids come in or teenagers come in, they're always shocked to find they need more vaccines because they were told this
was
the last
stop.
One. So starting with probably a more recent and a little more controversial vaccine, according to some folks, is the Gardasil, or the vaccine for human papillomavirus, which is responsible for cervical cancer, and I'll bet also for esophageal cancer and oral cancer as well at some point. Mm-hmm. We'll learn about that hopefully in the future. And, you know, I think our American Academy of Pediatrics recommends this for kids 9 and older, girls, and they're testing boys now. And I think if you're talking about prevention, which I think is the way to go, I think, obviously, this makes a lot of sense. It's been proven to be safe and effective, not 100%. I think there's still 20% of the viruses aren't being covered that cause cancer, so it's not a license to be sexually active. But if you're an unfortunate recipient of human papillomavirus, you know, there's certainly a good possibility that you'll develop cervical cancer over your lifetime. So we're really, I encourage people to consider that vaccine. And not everybody's willing to do it, but I think overall most people are accepting of it. So that's an important vaccine that will be probably upgraded in the near future to cover some other serotypes. Another one is, in the past we've used MMR. We've given kids 2 measles, mumps, rubella vaccines. So initial one and a booster. We're finding that we need to do the same for chickenpox vaccine. So the kids that get their varicella vaccines at 12 to 18 months should be receiving a booster in kindergarten, or if they are past kindergarten at some point when they come in for a checkup, can consider that, because that cuts down on the risk of acquiring chickenpox from 80% to like 96% effective in preventing the chickenpox. Hepatitis A, we're being, in the past we were just immunizing high-risk groups, which would be people that, you know, are going to be exposed, more likely to be exposed, or people in the Southwest. But now we're using hepatitis A as a standard vaccine for kids now. We're starting the first dose at a year, which it's really a fairly frequent problem. That's the infectious hepatitis that you can catch from food handlers, water, kids, and daycares. And then Menactra, or a vaccine for meningococcal meningitis, we're starting to give this vaccine at age 11. And in the past, we've just reserved it for kids going into college or going to be living in dorms or military. So that's another change in the vaccine schedule. And the vaccine that I really have appreciated the most recently is this vaccine for rotavirus, which is an oral vaccine. Rotavirus causes vomiting and diarrhea in kids, and it's the number one reason for kids to be in the hospital if you look at all diagnoses. And we've cut back on the hospitalization from this bug by 90%. And it was a quiet hospital to some degree as far as rotavirus goes this past year. So I'm really very impressed with that vaccine.
Okay.
So news. I don't know of any up-and-coming ones. So teenagers, if you've had all these, I think you're safe for at least a year.
Until they come up with something else.
Right.
All right. Another caller here, and this is someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I hate to say this, but, when I was growing up, I was born in the mid-30s. And when I was growing up, there wasn't the obesity we have today. But at the same time, people smoked. And I remember I was up to 3 packs a day, and I finally gave it up, and I immediately gained 30 pounds. And I'm wondering, I'm not recommending by any means, incidentally, that people start smoking to cut that back weight. That would be disastrous. I think if I hadn't quit, I would have been dead by now. But I'm wondering just how much of obesity is linked to people quitting smoking. I'll take my answer out here.
Okay.
I think it's kind of well known that after you stop smoking, there is some increase in weight for a lot of people. Unless they have lung cancer and then go the other way, which would be sad. And, you know, I think your point being that some substances decrease appetite. And I can just bring up some of the medications we use in kids suppress appetite. And unintentional consequences are they don't gain weight. Sometimes they have little growth issues. So we have to monitor that. There is really research going on right now, and don't ask me specifics, really regarding hormones and various substances that reduce someone's appetite, if you will, or gives them the feeling that they're full. And I think those the research there is going to be important because I look at, you know, the success rate that we're having with our management as being less than adequate. So for some people, this with really morbid obesity, this may really be a key to their treatment is pharmacology. And I can't say it's a panacea, but we have lots of people looking at that now. I'm sure there's big incentives to do so as far as the pharmaceutical companies are concerned, because it's going to be a big hit. But because we've got a one pill cure all, but for some people, there may be something to that, and we'll just have to see.
Okay. Interesting. Another caller here, Whiteheath, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was just commenting on that fellow that called in about weight gain because the people stopped smoking. And I used to smoke years ago, and so when I see a person smoking, I always thought, oh, I'm going to get really obese. And it's not true. I've seen so many people smoking that are really heavy set that I don't know. I don't think it helps to smoke to keep your weight down because there's a lot of obese people smoking out there. So I think there's some other reason for it.
Okay. Is it not also the case that weight gain after quitting smoking tends to be kind of a temporary thing? I mean,
yes,
it's a deal that you want to have something to do, you know, sort of like something
habit.
To do. It's an oral habit, and that if you can get past that first, you know, however long it is, generally that's something that you can do. It's not going to be should not be a long-term problem.
And I'll congratulate both callers on stopping because it's really incredibly important.
Yeah. That's something you talk about with your patients? Is that something you routinely ask your patients? Do you smoke?
I ask the kids in late middle school and high school. I asked an 11-year-old at one point just because he smelled like smoke and I thought it was his father smoking, and he said, no, I'm going to quit, though. And I dropped my jaw. And he, you know, obtained his tobacco from half of his parents. So it was a tough call. But you know, we talk about it, and it's nice to see that the number of kids that are smoking actually in high school and in middle school has probably dropped to some degree over the years. And so it's not really a common practice now. So, and I'm happy to see that, at least in my practice. It's interesting that college students, though, there's a group of college students, about 20% of college students in the first year start smoking.
And that's they start at that point.
They start smoking, which is bizarre. So I have not seen much more on that, but that certainly ties into the social setting that they're in, I guess. Yeah. But it's kind of bizarre. I think they'd be smarter than that.
Think so. Line number. I want to thank last caller. We'll go to another caller here. This is line two, and in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering have you discussed this? But how much salt would have to do with obesity? I mean, something like some of these, like Hormel microwave dinners. 51% of your daily sodium in one dinky little meal. And everything you look at, I mean, the salt content these days of things is just horrendous.
Yeah. Well, salt, as far as I know, is not responsible for obesity. Now, salt, you know, of course, if you retain fluids, it certainly can be an issue. And also, if you're hypertensive, you know, for some people, it's not particularly good for their blood pressure, but there's no calories involved. So it really may hold a little water, but it probably has more impact on people long-term that are hypertensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have to restrict their salt intake to some degree. I just usually say no. For my patients, if they were to ask me, I'd just say don't add table salt. You know, don't have a salt shaker on the table for most people, and that's satisfactory.
So that obviously, though, I think your point is, and I'm sure people have heard about this, that there certainly is this relationship between high sodium in the diet and hypertension and high blood pressure. That's a risk factor for heart disease, so for other things. So you don't want to, obviously, you know, uncontrolled high blood pressure is a bad thing, too.
Right.
Is that something that do you see in some of the children that you're concerned about with weight issues and these other things? Also, are you seeing kids with hypertension?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you do. There's several, you know, kind of settings. One is the family that has hypertension in the family, which is a risk factor. And then there's the kids that are overweight. That if you're overweight, your blood pressure does go up. So it's a double whammy. You've got diabetes, high blood pressure, and lipids that are out of order, and that's a triple whammy. So, yeah, it all ties in together.
Yeah. We have a couple minutes here. I just wanted to ask you about something real quick, and I thought about this when you were talking about immunizations. Just recently on the program, we had in Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an OBGYN, and she's here every other month. We talk about women's health, and we were talking about the Gardasil and talking about potential side effects. And she mentioned the fact that apparently there are some numbers of teenage girls who get the shot and then they faint.
Yes.
And I started thinking, well, that's interesting. Does that have something to do with Gardasil? And apparently,
no.
It has something to do with getting a shot.
Yes.
Because also that there's apparently some now CDC, FDA are reporting, getting more reports of people 5 and older, mostly teenage girls, who are fainting soon after getting a vaccination. So it's not just the Gardasil.
It's not the Gardasil.
It's the shot. What do you think is going on?
If you give the kids a shot of saline, which is nothing, the same thing's going to happen. If some of these kids that do this, that faint or pass out, are more likely to do that. So it's kind of they're predisposed to that. It's not
just
the whole
an anxiety
population.
Sort of thing?
It's kind of called a vasovagal response. And if these people, a lot of times if they see something bloody or gruesome, I mean, I've had parents pass out on me when I'm doing something to their child. They're over in the corner. Would somebody grab the mother, please? you know, seeing something traumatic, painful stimuli, just thinking about it. I have one patient that when I say you're you know, due for an immunization, he pretty much turns pale and we lay him down. We haven't done anything yet. We had to do the immunizations in the recline if you're supine position. So it's more common in teenagers. And so typically we're supposed to have the teenagers hang around for 15, 20 minutes and warn the parents that they need to kind of keep an eye on
them. Just to make sure that's okay.
They're walking out because they'll pass out in the parking lot.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I go for my regular annual physical and then I have to go and give blood so they can do cholesterol and all that because I will freely admit, I do not watch.
Exactly.
When they stick the needle in,
exactly.
I turn away.
Exactly.
I do not watch. I don't want to see that.
Exactly.
So I'm not gonna hold it against anybody else if they feel a little queasy after getting shot. I don't want to see it. Go ahead and take it. I know you have to have it. I don't want to watch.
Okay. Sounds like a good strategy. So.
Any last sort of thing that you'd sort of like to leave with folks or that you'd mention in about a minute that we have left?
I just appreciate the callers and their comments and their suggestions. I think, I kind of tend to be editorializing here a little bit, but I truly believe that we need to really look at society itself, and somebody needs to get a grip on this healthcare situation that we're dealing with. It's going to break the bank. We're not going to get as good a result if we look at where we're going right now. So and it's all tied up in politics and insurance and a number of things. And so I really am hoping that we'll have some newcomers to the healthcare field that are going to pick this ball up and run with it.
All right. Well, at that, we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carle Clinic. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. Mm-hmm.